Hi there. This is Arielle Garten, and I'm the founder of Muse. And you're listening to the Wealthy Wealthy podcast with my wonderful friend, Christina Wise.
You are at the intersection of wealth, health, and happiness. Welcome to the Wealthy Wealthy Life. Hello, this is Christina Wise, and welcome to the Wealthy Wealthy Life. In this edition, I talk to Ariel Garten. Ariel is a neuroscientist, and she's also a psychotherapist, which is really interesting. And she's trained in neurolinguistic programming. The woman is amazing. You will love her. She also has a background in fashion design. So when you see her, she always looks like a million bucks. Like, she's beautiful. She's brilliant. She's this incredible soul. And I can't even say enough good things about her. But beyond that, she really has studied the brain, the neuroscience, the brain, and she has a passion to help us get better connected to the power of our brain. And teaching us about the newest, latest science about our brain and the fact that our brains are plastic, meaning we can create these new neural pathways and neurogenesis. And historically, we've thought kind of like the brain was fixed. And she's going to share with us that that's not the case anymore. Like, that's science has told us otherwise. We can actually train our brain, grow our brain at any age. And at any age, you can keep from the brain from aging and really move away from all that brain fog and loss of memory. And we talk a lot about meditation and really how easy it is to start a practice of meditation, but more importantly, how important meditation is for the overall health of our brain, especially in today's stressful, fast-paced lifestyles. So enjoy this interview with Ariel. She's great. And have fun. Ariel, it's so awesome to have you here at the Wealthy Wealthy Conference. And you were sort of the star of the show. Everybody loved what you had to say. You're an amazing presenter. But more than that, you just speak from the heart. And so first of all, you're this beautiful woman and you're a neuroscientist. Tell me about this world of being a neuroscientist. What is it? What do you do?
So as a neuroscientist, you study the brain. And it can be defined in many forms. For me, that's meant running a company that has 50 people, a good portion of them run a lab that look at how we create applications and experiences using EEG. So we have PhD neuroscientists, computer scientists, engineers, all looking at how you understand brain activity and then create experiences that help you optimize kind of your relationship to the world through that.
Yeah, and so we'll talk about this technology that you've invented that's really awesome to help us get there. But before we get there to talk about that, can we talk about the brain a little bit? Because I think what we're learning is there's so much neuroscience that's kind of disproving what we believed about the brain, that it was, you couldn't change it, that we sort of learned and we couldn't really learn or change our brain after a certain age, and we're kind of stuck there. What do we now know about the brain? What are some things that we've learned over maybe the last decade that most of us don't know about the brain?
Well, so along that brain, I think most people are becoming aware that our brains are very plastic. So everything that you do builds new neural connections, new connections between two neurons. Listening to this conversation or having a conversation with somebody else is probably forming new neural pathways as you go. Also, we perceive that the brain couldn't create new brain cells into adulthood, and that's not true. So there's an area called the dentate gyrus of your hippocampus, and that is where new brain cells are born. And one of the best ways to actually create neurogenesis, the birth of new brain cells in your dentate gyrus, is exercise. So that link between brain and body, you know, is strong.
Yeah, I've heard movement, like the brain loves movement. Is that correct? Is it the motion or just working the body? Do we know?
It's working the body, and then through exercise, various factors, cofactors come up, and you create sort of a chemical condition in your body through exercise that encourages all sorts of amazing changes.
So yeah, normally we don't connect the exercise and the brain. So our brains are plastic, meaning this neurogenesis, we can create new brain cells all the time and create new pathways and connections. And so what does that mean as we age?
So that means that there's lots of stuff that you can do as you age to keep your brain from quote unquote aging. I mean, we're all going to age, but mm-hmm. there are certain biological definitions of aging. And those include basically things shrinking or things undergoing oxyradical damage. These are part of our sort of biological definitions of aging. And there, although time will go on, there are things that you can do to stave off some of those kinds of aging effects. So meditation is one thing that's actually really interesting for staving off parts of the aging brain. There's one study that comes out of Dr. Sarah Lazar at Harvard that shows as you age, your prefrontal cortex thins. That's a standard known practice. Your prefrontal cortex is part of your attentional control system. She did a study demonstrating that long-term meditators are able to maintain the thickness of your prefrontal cortex as they age, to the point where one gentleman at the age of 50 had the thickness of a prefrontal cortex of a 23-year-old.
Wow. So let's talk about that. I started off at the conference here. I shared that I come from Arizona and I grew up in central Arizona, Sedona area. And back then, like, meditation and yoga were really big, but people came there because it was woo-woo and unconventional, and, you know, weirdo people did that, you know, but that was very normal, this meditation yoga thing, that at the time, you know, like I said, it was very woo-woo. Now some of this stuff's become a little bit mainstream, but there was no science back in it. I mean, there'd been more of a practice that had been carried over for, you know, for centuries, basically.
2,000 years,
exactly.
Yes.
But from a Western approach, it didn't fit. It was weird. But now what is, like, so let's talk about from neuroscience perspective. Now we're learning, like, oh no, not that woo-woo stuff that we're doing in Sedona, that yoga and specifically meditation is good for the brain. Talk about that more. Like, why is it good for the brain? What are we learning from a scientific level that this meditation thing is so important, especially in this crazy fast-paced lifestyle we live in?
Sure. So meditation has now been demonstrated in probably over 1,000 published journals articles to be efficacious for anxiety, depression, decreasing pain, helping you be more in the present moment, and on and on and on. Some of the reasons is because meditation makes real changes in your brain. And Dr. Lazar is one of the foremost thinkers in that space. So she demonstrated that 8 sessions of meditation were able to increase the density of your gray matter. So that means more connections in your gray matter, more connections in your brain. There's also research demonstrating that meditation decreases the activation of your amygdala. Your amygdala is your fight or flight response. So as we think of ourselves as evolved human beings, we're individuals who want to be able to choose how we react, choose how we respond to situations, not simply be driven by our biology to be anxious, to freak out, to run away, to fight, to do all of these things that we may not consider as wise and cause us to make less good decisions in the actions in our lives. Meditation also decreases the activation of the default mode network. So the default mode network is that relationship between your prefrontal cortex and your PCC, your cingulate cortex. And the relationship in your default mode network, that firing happens when you're at rest, when you're not really doing anything. If you put somebody in an MRI machine and tell them to do nothing, you're still going to see the default mode firing. And that's your internal chatter. It's what meditation may refer to as the monkey mind, as we may refer to as our inner dialogue. It's that little thing that's always constantly going that you typically have very little control over or engagement with, and it's just feeding you stuff all the time. As you meditate, you actually decrease the activation of that default mode network, which is why as a meditator, we have the experience of decreasing the chatter of the monkey mind, being able to have a quote unquote clean blank slate. You know, there's no such thing as a clean blank slate, but that's sort of part of the existential experience that you have of it. And from there, you're able to more efficiently and effectively choose the contents of your own thoughts and direct your own mental process and where you want it to go.
And so I've heard people frame it up a little bit, like meditation can somewhat be correlated to exercising your mind, like working it, like exercising. Is that true?
Yeah,
is that
absolutely
okay?
So one of the definitions of meditation is training your brain to healthy and positive states. So meditation is not actually a woo-woo thing. There's a beautiful spiritual component if you choose to go that way. But if you don't, meditation is really the process of brain training. And at the core of a lot of meditation practices is training your attention. So most people think that meditation is simply letting your mind go blank. Like, let's just wait till for nothing to happen in your brain and someday I'll get to enlightenment. It is just not true and it doesn't happen. What meditation is training your brain. And sometimes you'll start with a focused attention on the breath practice. And you're honing your attention, your ability to control and manage your attention. So you may be focused on your breath and you try to come to a single-pointed attention. And as you can, you might focus on a candle or a mantra. And then when a thought comes in, it's your job to not follow that thought, to maintain your focused attention. So that then allows you, when distractions arise in your environment, to not be pulled in by those distractions. It also allows you, when distractions come in your internal environment, negative thoughts, feelings, ruminations, to not be pulled into those and to have a choice about where you put your attention. So then once you do this process of attention training, you can move into the phase which is open monitoring, which is using this attention that you've built to then move it around the environment and move it around your thoughts and be able to observe your thoughts, be able to observe your environment. So one of the definitions of mindfulness is non-judgmental observation of your thoughts, feelings, and experience in the moment to moment. So we're just asking somebody to observe what goes on inside. To not be driven by it, to not respond to it, to not have crazy autonomic arousal as a result of it, but to engage in the process of watching it, being with it, being comfortable with it, knowing it.
It's kind of watching your thoughts on a movie screen or something.
Yeah.
Be an observer and separating from those thoughts, right?
Exactly. And then being able to make choices from there, from the position of being a wise observer rather than engaged on a roller coaster.
And just reactive without being thoughtful first. And then meditation has been a practice that's been around forever and probably always needed. But I would guess that it's probably more needed now than ever because of all the distractions and the noise and everything pulling at us and just this constant go, go, go in this 24/7 new age time we live in. So how do people incorporate this? Like, I think we're starting to read and know that meditation is healthy, but that's great. What do I do? You know, how do I incorporate this? How do I start to take advantage of the benefits that I could acquire by result of being able to, you know, incorporate this practice into my life?
So you can sit there quietly and observe your thoughts or focus on your breath. One of the reasons we make Muse is because it's a beautiful practice and great, and you should absolutely and totally do it. A lot of people discover when they try to do that their brain is still just bouncing all over the place and they get frustrated and they feel like they don't know what they're supposed to do. I mean, there's lots of ways to meditate, but it's hard to know how to access it. So we built Muse as a tool that teaches you a focused attention meditation, and it actually gives you real-time feedback on your own brain. So that experience of watching your own mind, of watching your thoughts, becomes something that becomes visible, that becomes something that becomes tangible to you. Because what we do is we actually let you hear your own mind. So Muse is a clinical-grade EEG used in over 120 research institutions, and it tracks your brain activity in real time and then translates your brain activity into guiding sounds. Very specifically, when your mind is thinking, distracted, ruminating all over the place, that kind of bouncing monkey mind that we're also familiar with, you hear it as windy. And as you're guided to a state of clear, focused attention, it quiets those winds. So you're very easily able to hear and understand your busy mind versus your quiet mind. And you're given this guide, these tools that help you get into that quiet mind state and then encourage and reinforce you to stay there.
Yeah, and I think that's the... what I've heard from most people is I tried it, but I didn't know what to do. I didn't know if I was meditating, and it's easy, but at the same time, it's harder than one thing. So in order to kind of figure out how to get started on this thing. And so, yeah, that's what I love about Muse is, and it makes it enjoyable. So it turns it into something you look forward to because you put this thing on your head and you have your headphones, you go to find your own space and it becomes something to look forward to.
Totally. It's this absolutely beautiful experience of your own mind. And you sit there and you muse for as little as 3 minutes. And when you're done, you feel calmer. And when you're done, you've begun to build a little bit of a skill. And then the next time you do it, you feel even calmer. And then you start to get what some of the experiences of meditation is like. You get what a focused meditation feels like. And then you're able to take that into the world. And then all of a sudden, when things become distracting out in the real world or they pull your attention, you have this thing that you know that you can do. And you can take your mind off of those distractions and bring them to the state of just clear focus.
Yeah, and that's where muse is so great, is that biofeedback piece where it's like, oh, I can recognize the difference. Like I have this noise, I know what that feels like, and I have the birds and I know what that feels like. And being able to start the self-awareness and being able to really, I guess, be aware of what's going on to be able to be more, like when you are trying to be more conscious of it, you know what to relate it to.
Yeah, that and feeling, then you know what to
or
do.
That sense, right, exactly.
So, for example, if you're a kid who has focus issues, your entire life people yell at you to focus and you have just no idea what that means. And so if you start, you know, trying something like muse, you for the very first time in your life know what it means to focus. You finally have, you know, sort of vocabulary for it. You have the experience where you're like, oh, this is focus. And it just opens a whole new world. And as an adult, so I would be sitting in a lecture, and now that I've done a lot of musing, it's very easy for me to recognize when I'm actually paying attention to the lecture and when I'm not. And I didn't recognize that like 80% of the time I just wasn't paying attention to what I was doing. I had one of the very loveliest thing somebody told me is that she was a mom and she realized that when she was in the park with her kids, she was just never focused on her kids. She was always thinking about the grocery list. She was just thinking about what she was making for dinner. And it never occurred to her that she was never actually with her kid until she was actually able to train that focused attention and understand what it meant to truly be present, to actually be with the world around you and to have that skill and build that skill and recognize it.
And that's where life is in this present moment. And we spend so much time out there somewhere that we're not here. And so absolutely, I wanted to tell a couple of stories that, so one woman I talked to recently, her son has been diagnosed with ADHD. He's a teenager. I think he's 15 or 16. And so she bought a muse. Actually, I recommended it. And so she bought a muse and her son's been using it and she uses it too. And she gets a bird here and there, but he has ADHD, has a hard time focusing at school, all over the place. But he, in his meditation, through the tracking, he gets all numbers of birds. And she's like, what is this? The kid cannot focus outside of this and all the school issues, but he puts this muse on. So he has this ability to focus and he knows the difference. But since then, it's really transformed his ability, his schoolwork, because he now has this ability to recognize these sensations like, oh, I'm in this and I'm just going to pull it back and focus on the birds in his schoolwork.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. So as a disclaimer, this has not been validated for use with ADHD. We don't say that you should use it with ADHD. And if he's found benefit for his focus, that's totally amazing.
Yeah, and that's been her report.
Not something that comes from us, but from a mom, that's heartwarming.
Yeah, but I thought what was fascinating about that was, yes, the ADHD, which was cool that that's worked for him, but she's all focused and everything. I mean, she's planned and focused and like this mom. And she's like, I can't get the birds he does. So it's almost, the irony is that in this situation, like when he has a space to like really let go and listen for the birds, he actually can focus and focus so much that he gets more, you know, they're kind of competing and he's hands down winning, right? On just the quiet and the overall measures on the app. So that's one story. Go ahead.
So for clarification, for anybody who doesn't know, when you're very, very quiet, when you're in this real state of focused attention, you get birds. And so birds are a marker of just how engaged you are.
Yeah. And it's always fun. It's like, I got a bird. Yeah. And then it's so another story I want to share with you is that, so a good friend of mine, Lori, she's here at the conference. Well, she bought a muse yesterday based on, you know, after your talk. And so she's been using a really great app that I really recommend for people just starting meditation. It's called Headspace. Mm-hmm. And so she's been doing Headspace and she's to get her into this meditation practice. And I think she's been doing it for like 70 days in a row or something. So relatively new, but still very proud that every day she's, mm-hmm. It shows you how many days in a row that's been successful. So she got a muse yesterday. She mused this morning. But what her report was, she said she's getting a little tired of not necessarily Headspace, but like she felt like she hit a plateau and she's like, is there something more than this or whatever? So you'll have to talk to her maybe after our conversation. But she said she did muse this morning and she was all this wind. And so she just said, you know, universe, help me be quiet. Like just take the thoughts away and I'm just going to be here in the quiet. Bird. But she said she just had this moment and the biofeedback was so helpful because it actually, again, gave her that feedback that, oh, and kind of gave this whole new excitement and reinvigoration around continuing to meditate because she actually could experience it differently than just actually the practice itself.
Yes. And I hear that so often. So Muse is amazing for people who've never meditated before and are starting their meditation. It's also great for people who already have a meditation practice. And this gives you new insight into your meditation. It gives you an entirely new quality. I mean, as somebody who meditates, we are consciousness explorers. You know, we are discovering all of the aspects and the qualities of our own mind and what we do with it and how we appreciate it. And so this gives you new insight that you've never had before into your mind, not just into how your meditation practice is going and you get data on your meditation, all that, it's cool. But even far more fascinating is this insight into yourself, into your own mental process.
Yes. And I love Muse meditation. I meditate and it's made the biggest differences in my life. I mean, total transformation from being too busy to meditate, that uber performer, type A personality, go, go, go. You know, I thought I got brownie points for that I'm too busy to meditate. And, you know, life completely changed by incorporating the meditation practice into just my everyday life. And like biggest growth and achievements and everything have happened since meditation. So again, and probably now that the science backing up with the brain and all these other attributes that happen as a result of that grow as a result of meditation. But what I love about Muse, in addition to that, is the technology, is the, there's so much, even though meditation's been around forever, I do like some of this new technology now, like Muse, that makes it easier, makes things more enjoyable, turns something that's kind of been hard work before into something to look forward to. Mm-hmm. And so you've done such an amazing job making meditation easier, opening it up to a space that people actually want to explore it because it's such a life-changing practice that, you know, benefits us physically, emotionally, spiritually, however we wish to use it. And then making it fun, like the Muse is fun. And every day you've gamified it to like, how many birds and how am I doing? And I have to do so many more meditations before I unlock the next level. And so, you know, congratulations on what you've done there. And then all based in science, it's EEG, it's reading the brainwave. So talk a little bit about that. Like this is real stuff, real science.
So first, I actually want to talk about the gamification of it. So one of the things that we ran up against as we were building this is how do you build a meditation tool with things like gamification that keep people engaged and starting on their path, but don't actually fundamentally undermine what meditation is, which is a non-goal-directed practice. So the birds are one of the things that we've done to kind of undermine the goal-directed practice. So the bird is technically a reward because when you're very quiet, you get a bird. And as soon as you figure out that the bird is a reward and then you get excited that you got the reward, the bird flies away.
Yeah.
And so that's your very first lesson in letting go of rewards.
It's so true. Yes.
And then the more you use Muse, the more it moves from this extrinsic reward of, oh, I got points, to this intrinsic reward of, oh, I see the value in my life. There's a great article in the Wall Street Journal where the writer Michael Hsu had a Muse competition with Dan Harris, the ABC anchor and author of 10% Happier. And, you know, two guys, super competitive. They're like, who's going to get more points? And like, first, Dan got more points because obviously he's a great meditator. And then Michael got more points. And then they were like angry at each other. And then at the end of the article, it ends up with, we don't know who got more points because it doesn't matter because we're getting the benefit of using it every day.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
And so for us, it becomes, once meditation becomes enjoyable for you, it's the gateway to 2,000 years of tradition and history. It's the beginning technique so that you can then move into like a Shinzen Young basic mindfulness practice. You can then move into, you know, see, hear, feel. You can move into all of these different ways to meditate that exist. And then people sometimes will do, once you become more experienced, a 5-minute Muse meditation before an hour-long meditation from another tradition. So Muse will drop you right in, and then that other meditation will expand your practice in different directions. And then we have people building programs for Muse, like Deepak Chopra just wrote meditations for it. And we have amazing practitioners who've been building out new ways to use Muse and to spend time with your busy mind and love your busy mind and bring that activity into your daily life too.
Well, I really want to encourage everyone to meditate. And again, you've made it so easy to do that, to incorporate that practice into these busy lives or busy lifestyles. And at any age, right? From young to old. I mean, you have kids using this and, you know, from I don't even know, maybe your oldest muser, but...
Oldest musers probably in their 90s.
Yeah, see, that's so incredible.
Yeah, so in some of the studies that we're doing, we have schools that are using Muse where kids were tracking their improvements in grades and decrease in emotional arousal and improvement in emotional self-regulation. McMaster University is doing a study on Muse for age-related cognitive decline. I mean, I'd never say that it is good for that, but they're doing a study with Muse with the elderly and extreme elderly. Mayo Clinic is currently engaged in a study with women who are breast cancer sufferers.
Oh, wow.
So they get a Muse 4 weeks before surgery to ideally decrease the stress of the surgery process and possibly even improve their recovery times. Harvard is using it with Spalding Rehab in Boston for traumatic brain injury.
That's incredible. So we need to wrap up. Part of what we're hoping to do through Wealthy Wealthy is sort of expose some of the conventional wisdom out there that's actually just false. But, you know, we've sort of incorporated these beliefs and it's become popular beliefs. But now, like the latest science or knowledge, we just realized it's just flat out wrong. So is there sort of in this meditation, brain science, neuroscience world, like health of the brain, is there any sort of popular beliefs out there that are just flat out wrong, and as a result, people are kind of going down the wrong path?
So I would never say that someone or something is flat out wrong, mm-hmm. but I know you and I were chatting earlier, and one of the things that came up is this, you know, often held notion that in order to make money, you have to do something that's bad for the world, or making money is evil. That is absolutely not what I believe and absolutely not what I've lived. You know, I always say that if what we're doing is not helping the world in some way, literally throw it in the garbage. I don't need to do it. And I really encourage people to understand that you can follow your passion of making the world a better place and become economically viable and successful while doing it. And it's not a binary choice between making money and, you know, doing good. And so often I see people, you know, make money in things that aren't that great for the planet or the people around it. And their justification is, oh, well, so I can make lots of money so that later I can be a philanthropist and then give to these causes and then, you know, solve the world's problems. And that is just a waste of all of that initial energy. And it may seem like a get rich quick scheme or, you know, if I do this then, you're not putting good things into the world, and you really, really, truly can follow your actual dreams and your actual passions and make money while doing it. And part of what I love to talk about and teach people is that you can truly accomplish anything that you want. You know, we have this little voice in our head called the inner critic that tends to tell us awful things like you're not good enough, or, you know, your hair looks stupid, or what do they think of me? And it's never right, and it's never true. And so one of the reasons that we created Muse was to help people understand that you could master that voice in your head and that you can have the opportunity to take the things that your mind tells you all the time and change your relationship to it and not be just, you know, driven by them, but make choices, not necessarily based on them, but based on what you actually want to do in the world. Choices based on, you know, deeper knowledge and deeper wisdom so that you're not driven by the fear and insecurity, but you're driven by what you want and what you choose and who you want to be and what you want to accomplish, because you absolutely can.
Well, that is so beautifully said, and I don't think that there's anything we could say to top that. So thank you, Ariel. I'm just so honored to know you and for you to be here, and I just want to continue to deepen my relationship with you and help you however I can. But really, more than anything, thank you for your contribution to make the world a better place.
Thank you for the opportunity to share.
Awesome. Wow, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Ariel and that you're totally inspired to add meditation into your life, that you now agree that meditation really is important as a performer, and it's an important component for happiness and overall well-being. So we talked a lot about mind health, about mental intelligence, cognitive intelligence. Well, for next episode, we're going to jump into a conversation about emotional intelligence with my friend, Dr. Joan Rosenberg. We're going to talk about emotions and the high performer, and how to master our emotions in the way that our emotions completely serve us instead of the opposite, that for many of us, that our emotions have the best of us versus, you know, they're in control of us versus we being in control of them. And she offers so many tips and new ways of thinking and new ways of getting connected to our emotions for overall health and wealth. So don't miss next episode with Dr. Joan Rosenberg. As always, thanks for tuning in, and I'll talk to you next time.